Blog Talk Radio.
Edition of the Cyril Quinn Review on this 3rd of May 2014. We'll be checking you for the next 2 hours. We have a big show today. We have a couple guests on to talk about this major Saturday and this major weekend of sports, a jam-packed show, NBA playoffs, Kentucky Derby, NFL drafts, a ton going on in the world of sports. As always, the call number is 347-215-6180. You can follow me on Twitter at William Gerald, or hit me up on Facebook at William. Hit me up on Facebook at www.facebook.com/William Gerald, or go to my website surrealgeraldquinn.com. You know, the NBA. The NBA's had a tough time this postseason. Off the floor, we understand what transpired with Donald Sterling. You know, the passing Jack Ramsey this week, which we'll talk about later in the program. But despite that, this first round of games has been as good as there's ever been in NBA history. I mean, this has been the best period. This has been the best first round in NBA by far in NBA history. It's not even close. You're going to have 5 game 7s. You could have, Damian Lillard, 3-point buzzer beater away from having 6. But the NBA had to find a way to kind of step on his own foot. Yesterday, Zach Randolph gets suspended, and Paul George doesn't. Now, the NBA, of course, has a rule about the fighting or stepping off the bench. Paul George takes 2 steps off the bench, steps on the floor. He doesn't get suspended. Had no problem with it at the time. Had zero problem with it. I said, you know what? This NBA using discretion, not tarnishing their own product. Of course, Paul George, Indiana does not have a chance to win that game, even though they would be at home against Atlanta. Zach Randolph pushes Stephen Adams, not punches Stephen Adams, pushes Stephen Adams, and gets suspended. I don't understand it. How many times have we seen players in the playoffs shove each other, even above the neck? I mean, it happens all the time. You have to understand, that series, the Oklahoma-Memphis series, to me, has been one of the best first-round series that I've seen. I mean, you're talking about 6 games, 4 of them went to overtime. Games 2 through 5 all went to overtime. You could have Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook out the first round of the playoffs. You could have Memphis, go to the NBA Finals. I mean, who knows? Who knows what, if Memphis were to win this game, how far they can go. But now, they have no chance because, you have an injury, you have Mike Conley's banged up, and you have Zach Randolph out the game, and the game is in Oklahoma City. Now, Memphis has won 2 games in Oklahoma City, but that was with a healthy Zach Randolph and a healthy Mike Conley and Zach Randolph. But, again, if you're the NBA, you got to find a way to – I mean, you got to just use your noodle. I mean, use your common sense if you're the NBA. Don't hurt your own product. Nobody's going to criticize the NBA for not suspending Zach Randolph. Nobody even brought it up. I mean, it wasn't like when that play happened, I didn't hear any announcers say, well, I wonder Zach Randolph's status for Game 7. Nobody even brought it up. It just came out of nowhere yesterday. Zach Randolph has been suspended by the league. Like, what? he's been what? So, yeah, again, the Sterling fiasco has overshadowed this great postseason. You have to deal with that. There's no running away from it. We all know what that has been all about. But again, you had a chance to have 5 game 7s, and to have more of a focus on the court, the on-the-court product. And the NBA, you know, just, again, steps on his own foot, gets in his own way with that suspension. 347-215-6180. Again, busy program. Alex Brown will join us at noon to talk Kentucky Derby, and we'll also have some guests on to talk about the NBA playoffs. Just getting started here on this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. We'll be right back. Is your call number on this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. Big show for you. NBA playoffs, NHL playoffs. NHL playoffs have started. Second round has started. Rangers and Chicago Blackhawks are the winners last night. Rangers taking out the Penguins 4-3. Blackhawks over Minnesota, no surprise, 5-2. Again, Pittsburgh just... It doesn't matter how many goals they score. It doesn't matter how great their offense is. You know, until they get a championship caliber goaltender, they're not going to return to the Stanley Cup. I mean, Fleury is just not the answer. I mean, the Rangers could, you know, listen, it's not out of the realm of the possibility that the Rangers could win this series. You'll have Boston trying to rebound off a double overtime loss of Montreal. They're playing in about an hour or so, game two of that series. The LA Kings series will start off to this evening as they coming off that three game rally, coming off that rally being down 3-0, which has only been done I think one other time in NHL history. They start game one of their series against the Anaheim Mighty Ducks. Should be a tremendous series. So you are down to the 8 in the Stanley Cup playoffs. You saw the Viv Seviana interview yesterday with Barbara Walters, not the full with Barbara Walters, just maybe snippets of it, but just enough to kind of get a sense of where she was coming from in terms of her talking about Donald Sterling. And again, nothing that you heard from that interview is shocking. It's clear to me that she's trying to turn Donald Sterling into a martyr, trying to make him to be like, oh, you know, he's just, you know, he's old and lonely and, you know, he's really not a racist. It was the heat of the moment. He's poor Donald Sterling. And that's what she's clearly trying to do. I don't know how much he actually cares about Donald Sterling. You know, you let her tell it, she's the only person in the world that cares about Donald Sterling. Yet, you know, she allegedly embezzled $1.8 million away from him. So, I don't know the dynamics of that relationship, but I do know that she clearly has some type of agenda here, I don't think Donald Sterling is a clear racist. I mean, let's not forget about his words. Forget about that tape. You know, just look at his past practices, his business practices in the with the housing discrimination lawsuits. So, put you know, those I go by his actions more than I do his words. So I think she, you know, is just trying to. I don't know. Maybe someone. Maybe she does care a little bit about him. I don't know how much. I can't see that thing, their ordeal or their relationship being no more than just a business arrangement. So, again, it was only a matter of time before she came out and spoke. Sterling, of course, you know, came out. I think DeJour.com. I get it right. I mean, I wish I would have paid it off. So that was the first time he spoke about the situation, which, you know, there's no surprise that he would come out and say something like that. Of course, today, I mean, I wish I would just paid her off so she can basically shut up. So you have that with the Sterling situation. Interesting thing about this whole ordeal is it seems like Sterling is going to fight the NBA in court once the owners decide to vote him out, which they will. It seems like Sterling is more than comfortable with fighting the NBA out in court. You know, what happens if he owns the Clippers come this offseason into next season? What do the Clippers do with Doc Rivers, CP3, some of the other Clippers? That'll be one of the most intriguing aspects of this whole ordeal. So, this is, again, I said it on my program on Wednesday, far from over. This is far from over, people. This thing is just really just beginning. It really is. Floyd Mayweather will fight Marcos Medina tonight. Mayweather, of course, is a 11-1 favorite, rightfully, as he should be. You know, I wonder about Floyd in this fight. I don't know too much about his opponent. Seen him fight a couple times. Pretty good, pretty good fighter. He's not a tomato can. But I just wonder, you know, Floyd's mentality. They did an interview with Floyd yesterday. I believe it was Brian Kenny, who with Showtime, used to be with ESPN. And I just didn't get the sense, you know, Floyd was, you know, he was respectful of his opponent. He was laid back, and Kenny didn't mention it because, I mean, you know, I guess you're not trying to poke a pride at Floyd Mayweather Jr., but I just didn't get the sense that his head was into the fight. I mean, he said all the right things. He looks in tremendous shape. I mean, let's not kid ourselves with that. He looks like he's in tip-top shape, which you would expect in terms of his preparation, things like that. But I'm not even talking about the physical. I'm just talking about more of the mental. And we all know what transpired over the last couple of weeks, this week, with Floyd and his ex-living fiance, Chantel Jackson, formerly he's called Miss Jackson. Again, there was, you know, alleged rumors about how they broke up. Again, I don't like getting in people's personal lives, but he broke up with his longtime fiance, and you know, I don't care how much you're used to chaos. Because that was what Tony Teddy Atlas said. Hey, this is a guy who is used to chaos. This is his world. I mean, his uncle, his father, that whole ordeal. He's used to just things not being in order, and that doesn't affect him. But you know, when a breakup comes, you know, a breakup in a relationship is a different type of chaos. Okay. So again, I wonder about Floyd going into this fight. I'm not saying he's going to lose the fight. But should be interesting to see as he will fight tonight, 45-0. He puts his undefeated record on the line. 347-215-6180 is your call number. When we return, the power of the SEC, and we'll talk NFL draft. That's coming up on this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. We'll be right back.
House in Charmingtown, they call as the song. It's been the ruin of many a poor girl, and who got
46 minutes after the 11 o'clock hour in this latest edition of the Serial Queen Review. Busy show today. We'll talk about the Kentucky Derby at the top of the hour. 347-215-6180. NBA, NHL playoffs. NBA is going to have five game sevens, a triple header tonight of game sevens, starting with OKC taking on Memphis. You're going to have Golden State and the Clippers on tonight. Then you'll have also Toronto. You have Toronto and Brooklyn tomorrow. Dallas, San Antonio to cap it off. I'm forgetting one matchup. Indiana and Atlanta will also be. See, so many game sevens, I lost track of of everybody who's playing. So you have Indiana and Atlanta will be on as well today. First time in NBA history that you'll have three game sevens on the same day, and it just makes perfect sense that the first round would end like this because it has been a historic first round of playoff games. Just, I mean, the amount of overtime games, the shot making, the mistakes. I mean, how many of these games have we seen where teams have just gone out their way to just hand the game over? And you look at that Dallas-San Antonio game. Dallas almost gift-wrapped San Antonio the series with that, how they handled it at the end of the game. You know, Toronto, New Jersey a couple of days ago in that game five. So it'd be a very interesting next couple of days here in the NBA as the Miami Heat wait for the winner of the Toronto Brooklyn. They were able to wipe out Charlotte in four games here. NFL draft coming up in less than five days should be one of the most intriguing and anticipated drafts in recent memory. I don't know if I've seen a draft coming. First of all, NFL could do it at once. You know, pushing it back to May 8th as in comparison to usually the end of April, it seems like it's taking forever for the draft to get here. That's first. But, again, I guarantee you the rating for that NFL draft will be higher than the ratings for a World Series game, and it will probably be close to a ratings for an NBA Finals game. I guarantee you those ratings are going to be off the charts come Thursday night. So you have three days, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And again, the question remains, who's going to be taking number one? I mean, Houston, as Kemba has come out, already said that they're going to take, they know who they're going to take. I don't know if that's a smokescreen. I don't know if they actually know who they're going to take number one, but the Houston general manager came out and said on Thursday that they knew who they were going to take at number one. A lot of people feel like it's going to be Jhabbar Clowney, despite all the talk about his lack of hunger for the game, not playing on every down. He is the best talent in the draft, without question. He's the best talent in the draft, and the guy who probably has the most upside of any player in the draft as well, as far as just physical gifts, as a physical specimen. But who knows? I mean, you know, there's still. I mean, don't be surprised to see Atlanta try to trade up and get him. Don't be surprised if they take a quarterback. I mean, I still think Manziel is still in play here. And man, listen, man, where Manziel gets drafted, you know, Manziel could go top five or middle of the first round. I really think so. I think that, you know, there's been a sense of there's not even either people love Manziel or hate Manziel. I mean, you've heard either Manziel, you know, not being, you know, a top in the top three rounds, or you've heard people say, well, Manziel's the best player in the draft, or Manziel's a can, you have to take him. Again, you look at this quarter, you look at this draft of quarterbacks. It troubles me about the quarterbacks when you have guys who are coming out of nowhere, who are all of a sudden top quarterback prospects like Garofalo and guys of that nature, who break into the list of Bridgewater and Manziel and Blake Bortles. That would make me nervous about these group of quarterbacks. Because that will tell me that is there a legit franchise quarterback in this draft? That would make me very nervous. Again, you wonder how many of these guys who are projected to be first-round picks are legit first-round quarterbacks. So that's certainly something that you need to keep your eyes on. Also, keep your eyes on the receivers. There are a ton of receivers, and this is one of the deepest receiving classes in a long time. How many of these receivers will go in the first round? You know that Mike Evans and Sammy Watkins are first-round picks, will be automatic first-round picks. Sammy Watkins could be a top two, top three. People, Sammy Watkins will not fall outside the top five, so you know that. Mike Evans will not fall outside the top 10. But there's been a talk as many as five receivers could go in the first round. We'll see about that. Also, St. Louis and Cleveland. St. Louis has two first-round picks, two high first-round picks at that. I believe a 2 and a 13. Cleveland has two first-round picks. If you're St. Louis, listen, do you take the picks or do you trade down? You know, with that roster, it seems like they are leaning towards taking the tackle out of Auburn, Robinson, who's considered to be a can't miss prospect as far as a tackle, best upside as far as offensive tackle. Cleveland, who knows what Cleveland has in store at number four? Will they take Johnny Manziel if Manziel is there? Will they take him? Cleveland is always, you never know what Cleveland's going to do. San Francisco has 12 picks, so look for them to probably make some moves in terms of they have 12 picks overall. Jets have a bunch of picks. So I expect there to be a number of trades in this draft. I really do. I expect there to be a lot of moves made. I think you have a number of teams who are willing, whether it be Atlanta, the Jets, who are willing to trade up to get a player that they covet. The Jets want a receiver. Atlanta could want Jets, Jadavian Clowney. So you might see Atlanta maneuver to get the number two pick, or maybe get the number one pick. Should be, again, a fascinating draft. But we all know the star of the draft is without question Johnny Manziel, and where he is drafted, where he goes in this particular draft. 347-215-6180 is your call number. When we return, the power of the SEC. We'll talk about it on this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. We'll be right back.
On the first part of the journey, I was looking at all of life. There were plants and birds and rocks and things. There were sand and hills and rain. The first thing I met was a fly with a buzz and the sky with no clouds. The heat was hot and the ground was dry, but the air was full of sound. I've been through the desert on a horse with no name. It felt good to be out of the rain. In the desert, you can walking through the desert on a horse with no name. It felt good to be out of the rain. In the desert, you can't remember your name, cause there ain't no one for to give you no pain. La 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 la.
Six minutes after the 11 o'clock hour in this latest edition of the Cyril Kumar Review. So the SEC comes out with a schedule. They're going to play 8 games against each other. And it seems that you know, David Shaw, Stanford coach, has a major problem with that, because Pac-12, they're playing 9 games against each other. Listen, I give the SEC a ton of credit. You know, when we go through life here, we all know in the workplace, in any walk of life, that when you are talented, when you produce at a high level, you get away with things. Now, I'm not talking illegally, but just you get a little bit of rope, a little leeway. You know, maybe you can walk in, maybe you can come into the job, the office, 5 minutes late or 10 minutes late if you're a salesperson who's been setting records for sales, versus someone who is struggling to keep a job to sell anything being late. Like, wow, really, you're late? You haven't sold anything, but you're going to come to work late? Okay, we'll keep that in my mental Rolodex. The SEC has been the preeminent, dominant football conference for basically a decade now. I mean, for a long time, but especially in the last 10 years, and the BCS, the BCS era, okay, had a string of consecutive national championships snapped recently by Florida State. And if I'm the SEC, I'm saying to myself, why would I create more of an opportunity for a team out of my conference not to get to a playoff by playing an extra game against a conference opponent? Like, to me, it's very simple. If the SEC could afford to only play, you know, 6 games against each other, they would do it to make sure that that they have at least one team playing for a national championship. So if you're the Pac-12, if you're the Big Ten, if you're the ACC, you got a problem with it, so be it. Go out there and win national championships 7 to 8 straight years, and then you can start making the rules for yourself. I mean, when's the last time a Pac-12 team hasn't won a championship since USC? Okay. And the Pac-12 was good this year. It was pretty good this year. No, I'm not knocking it from that standpoint, but they're not the SEC. Again, when you're at the top, when you are the creme, you know, the creme de la creme, you can make your own rules. And I frankly have no problem. Listen, everybody, don't tell me, you can't sit up and tell me that if you have power, we all like power, okay? There's nobody walking this earth that doesn't like power, and we all like using power. Some people abuse it, some people use it, some people abuse it. You get opportunity to use power and flex your muscle, you're going to do it, especially when you're doing it at a high, high level. So I have no problem with the SEC does it. It's great business. David Shaw, you know what? It sounds like sour grapes to me. Joining us right now, Alex Brown, who, of course, covers horse racing, has been doing it for a long time, has been a staple of this program for now 6 years, breaking down these Triple Crown races. This is one of my favorite sports weekends of the year, without question. I love the Kentucky Derby. Alex, how you doing?
Very good, very good. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, no problem, Alex. Thanks for coming on. Alex, you're looking at this group of horses. First of all, how good is California Chrome, whose odds has dropped from 5 to 2, now the latest I saw, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, was 3 to 1. How good is this horse?
Well, can I tell you about 7 o'clock tonight?
Yes.
No, I'm kidding. I mean, on paper, on form, this year, California Chrome is the standout of this field. And on top of that, it'd be a great story if he wins. So I think, you know, we're all kind of rooting for him. But, you know, 5-2, 3-1, I think he's about a 4 or 5-1 shot in my book. If I'm a value better, I would bet him at 4 or 5-1. I think at 5-2, 3-1, that's a very short price. But nevertheless, he is the standout on form. So hopefully he runs his race and shows everybody what a superstar he is.
I was reading this when I was just, you know, talking about, I'm just looking up things about the Kentucky Derby and these horses. So is it true that he has not run outside, he has not won a race outside the state of California?
Correct. I mean, he's a California bred. He's never left the state of California. His trainer's never had a Kentucky Derby winner. So there are some things going against him. I mean, it's a big step up potentially for him to come to Kentucky and continue his form. The other question mark would be his pedigree is quite weak. So some will question whether he can get the mile and a quarter. But that all being said, he has absolutely dominated his division in California this year. Ran away with the Santa Anita Derby, which is a very solid prep race for the Kentucky Derby. So those that are supporting the horse, fair play. I mean, he should be supported. I mean, I wrote a story about this race, and he's my pick based on his brilliance this year. I just think at 5-2, there's probably value in looking at some other horses too. But, you know, I'm hoping that he can really show his stuff this afternoon. But 19 horse field, lots of different things can happen. And, you know, there is a couple of question marks about this horse.
Yes, and to give my audience a little background on some of the concerns of California Chrome coming out of the state of California. It's not so much coming out of the state of California, it's the fact that a California bred horse, well, maybe it is as well, it is. It's the fact that a California bred horse has not won the Derby since 62, and that was decidedly. So that, you know, history from that standpoint is going against California Chrome. Alex, how much do you think speed will dictate this race? Last year we saw horse the horse jump out on top of everybody, and that horse, particular horse, I can't remember the name right now, just faded and finished in 12th. Will this be a race of speed, or will this be a race of tactical race of patience?
Yeah, I mean, I think quite honestly, the Derby typically is a speed-oriented race early. You've got 19 horses, and very seldom will they go off at a slow pace to try to conserve some energy, because it is the first time any of these horses will go a mile and a quarter. But with the size of the field, you're typically going to get a fast run early race. That speed would then typically collapse and set the race up for those that are stalking and being a bit more patient. That's the idea anyway. But I do anticipate a fast run race early. I think Vic is in trouble coming out of the inside post. We'll look to get an early good position. Now, if they let Vic is in trouble out early and don't threaten him, he could be dangerous on the front. And there's certainly other speed horses in this race too. But I anticipate a very fast run race early. Now, if California Chrome gets his way, he'll want to be close on the front too, I suppose. So, yeah, I mean, it's going to be fast.
With that being said, give me some horses that favors if it indeed turns out to be a speed race.
Yeah, I don't absolutely know who typically it's going to favor, but obviously Wicked Strong is the other sort of main contender that a lot of people are excited about. He was unfortunately drawn in the outside post, so that sort of turned a few people off. But you know, that outside post isn't so bad if you can get a good drafting position behind the speed, as long as you don't get hung too wide around that first turn. And I presume that'll be the tactics for Wicked Strong, is to sort of find his way into about fourth, fifth, or sixth position going into the first turn, about three or four, five lengths off the pace. If he's not too wide, that's going to be a very threatening position for him. So his performance in the Wood Memorial was a breakout performance, and I think a lot of people will like him in this race today.
How about Opportunity, who, of course, was scratched earlier this week? How will that horse's absence affect this race, if it has any effect, if it will have any effect at all?
Yeah, I don't think it'll have much of an effect. He was hammered by California Chrome in his last race, so the fact that he was made second favorite on the morning line just shows you the respect everybody has for California Chrome. So, I mean, Opportunity's defection just, I think, strengthens the case for California Chrome, but other than that, it doesn't really have a lot of impact on the makeup of the race, I don't think. I didn't see Opportunity winning this race, to be perfectly honest.
Joel Rosario, who, you of course, you know very well, rode Orb at the Derby last year, Animal Kingdom at the Dubai race.
Yeah.
Can a jockey of that magnitude, can he raise the level of the horse? Let's say that he doesn't have the best horse. How much is he worth, a jockey of that magnitude, as he rides General A-Rod?
Yeah, honestly, I think you've got probably the 19 of the best 25 jockeys in North America riding today. And I don't know that, let's say, Joel Rosario is that much better than these other jockeys. So, you know, I think there's value in having experience, you know, a guy that's actually won this race, because they'll ride the race with a little bit more confidence and not get so sort of stirred up about, you know, the fact that they've never won the race. But other than that, I don't think it has that much relevance. These are the best jockeys in our sport, so they better be able to understand how to ride a decent race.
Has there been a lot of talk in your circles about what's going on with Steve Osserman?
Sure. I mean, honestly, I mean, I worked for Steve Asmussen for 2 years. So
Asmussen,
right, yeah. I've been involved in that conversation. So there's been a lot of chatter, and I can, you know, go into a bit more detail if you want. But I think certainly the fact that they won the Oaks yesterday with you know, in really good style with Untappable, sort of quieted some of that conversation. So, you know, Steve, very private guy. This has definitely blindsided him, this whole sort of situation that's going on. And, you know, he's got Tapajor in the Kentucky Derby today. I think if Tapajor wins, there'll be plenty of people that'll be a little less enthusiastic about that. But they had a huge win yesterday with Untappable in the Oaks. And she might actually show up in the Preakness after such a dominating win, so that would be exciting too.
So we have California Chrome, Wicked Strong. Yeah. Those are two horses you think can win this race. Give me the other horses you feel like can win this race.
Yeah, I mean, from what I'm hearing, Danza and Intense Holiday have both been training very well coming into the Derby. And I think that's important. How are the horses doing in the week leading up to the race? Something that you won't see in the form book. Dan's is kind of interesting because he won the Arkansas Derby, which is a key prep race for the Kentucky Derby.
Right.
It was a shock. It was a shock that he won, but nevertheless, it shows that he's sort of peaking at the right time, and the fact that he's training well leading up to this race. So you might get a bit more values going after Dan's.
intense holiday, by all accounts, has been training quite well leading up to this race too. So I think those two, if you're looking for a real long shot, well, morning line 30-1, I don't see how you can't look at Vickers in Trouble. He won the Louisiana Derby, and I think, you know, that's a pretty tough race to win in of itself. And Rosie Napravnik's on board. It would be a great story to have her win the Derby after winning the Oaks yesterday. So if Vickers in Trouble is given an early lead and not pushed, he's going to be very tough. So there's a lot of value there. And quite honestly, if you like the name of one of these horses, bet it, because it, outside of California Chrome, this is a very wide open field, I think.
So do you think this field, when you compare this field, and I certainly thought about Vickers in Trouble too. I was just about to mention her with Napravnik. Do you think that this field, how do you gauge this field as far as how strong is this field as in comparisons to past years? Is this a strong field? Is it an average field? Is it, you know, okay? Is it okay?
I think right now there's no real standout other than California Chrome, and there is some question marks about California Chrome. I don't think this is a strong field at this point. Now, come the end of the year, we might, you know, the conversation might be a little bit different. Maybe some of these horses really step up today and after the Derby and show that they're the real deal. But there's a lot of horses in this field that have been beaten by each other in various prep races and not really stood out. I was a huge fan of Orb last year, who ran through the spring in dominating fashion and just seemed to be improving. And he did what we thought. He stepped up and won the Derby. Unfortunately, he didn't train on after that particularly well. You know, outside of California Chrome, this is a group of horses that's kind of beaten up on each other, and that doesn't seem to be much of a real standout other than that one horse. So if California Chrome wins, great. If someone else wins, it may be a horse that's peaking and will go on and do well going forward, but they haven't really peaked at this point.
You mentioned Untappable winning the Kentucky Oaks yesterday.
Yeah.
A lot of talk around your sport is comparing Untappable to Rachel Alexandra. Do you see that comparison?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are natural comparisons to make, because Rachel Alexandra was also, was switched to Steve Asmussen after she won the Kentucky Oaks in her career, and obviously then went on to win the Preakness and do some other spectacular things. I think Untappable hasn't yet shown the same domination that Rachel Alexandra showed in the Oaks, when she won her Oaks. And Steve Asmussen is also keen to keep Untappable and Tapachore away from each other, because he thinks obviously Tapachore can run very well in the Kentucky Derby today. So if he does, he goes on to the Preakness, and Untappable will probably run in the Black Eyed Susan instead. So it's natural to make the comparisons with Rachel Alexandra. I mean, I hope at the end of the year, Untappable goes through the season undefeated, and she continues to do very well. But I think it's a little premature at this point.
So we could be facing another year where from everything I've gathered from you in the last 15 minutes, it's probably very highly unlikely that we get a Triple Crown winner this year.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to win the Triple Crown. Obviously,
right.
If a horse wins today in good fashion, you know, dominating fashion or whatever, then we can get excited about the Triple Crown. And I'm not saying that's not going to happen today. It just, you know, I don't see it at this point. Now, if California Chrome does dominate the race, then yes, we can start really getting excited. I don't think there's any other three-year-olds around that will come into the Preakness or the Belmont that aren't currently running in the Derby. In all honesty, I want California Chrome to win today, and I want him to win by a widening margin. I can get
right.
excited. I think there are a couple of question marks about him just because he's never been out of California, and his breeding is a little bit questionable to get this added distance. But the other side of it is he has been thoroughly dominating in his races this year. So if that horse shows up today and performs like that, then let's get excited. But we shall see.
So it's fair to say that California Chrome is the only horse that could win this race and generate Triple Crown talk. If any of these other horses were to win the race, whether it be Wicked Strong or Danza, they wouldn't generate the kind of Triple Crown talk or buzz that California Chrome would if he were to win this race.
I think less which horse wins, but in the fashion in which they win the race. So if any horse wins by running away from the race at the end, then we can get excited. It's just at this point, California Chrome looks to be the only one capable of winning in that fashion. But if Danza, proves that the Arkansas Derby wasn't a fluke, or if Wicked Strong proves that the Wood Memorial was the real horse and he continues to step up, or, Thick is in Trouble gets loose on the lead and shows that the Louisiana Derby win was no fluke. If any of that happens, then you can get excited, but they have to win well. By winning by a short margin and running a slow last quarter of a mile and in sort of an ugly fashion, then no, you're not going to get so excited about Triple Crown.
So you like California Chrome to win?
Yes.
Okay. Who do you like to place in the show?
I think, three or four horses to back him up would be Vickers in Trouble, Wicked Strong, Danza, pick a 50-to-1 show.
There you go, Alex Brown making his choices for the Kentucky Derby, which always should be an exciting race. You normally don't go with the favorites. It's unusual for you to pick the outright favorites, but you kind of get a sense that you really like this horse a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I picked Orb last year, I think.
Yeah, you did. That's true.
And I think he was favorite. So, obviously the favorite is the best horse on paper, otherwise I wouldn't make him favorite. And I just think he has been consistently a dominating horse. If he runs like he ran in the Santa Anita Derby, I guess that's the question. If he repeats that race that he did in the Santa Anita Derby, he's just going to be terrifically difficult to beat. It's a 19 horse field, so let's throw about four or five more horses in there and be safe. Be safe in our picks.
Well, Alex, as always, thanks for joining us. We'll be looking forward to have you on in a couple of weeks as we talk about the Preakness. Hopefully, we can be excited going to the Preakness about California Chrome. And, it's always, to me, my goal in terms of, in watching these races is always to hopefully get a Triple Crown winner horse with that kind of capability. We haven't seen one, of course, since 78. So, hopefully California Chrome handles his business and we can be talking about them going into the Preakness. Alex, thanks to you for joining me. We'll see you next time.
Very good. Thanks for having me. I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
All right, no problem.
All right.
Alex Brown, of course, joining us to talk about the Kentucky Derby. And listen, sounds like he loves California Chrome. Again, you never know what's going to happen in these races. With these races, I don't know how. The field to me, from everything I've read and I've seen on television, that this field is not a strong field, and Alex, of course, backed that up with what he said. So, with that being said, you have a field that's not that strong. You have one of the favorites, Opportunity, that drops out, that was scratched. So that would lean towards more than likely a California Chrome victory. Though, again, when I read that piece of information that California Chrome had not won a race outside the state of California and that a Derby winner outside the state had won a race and that a California bred horse had won a race, had won a Kentucky Derby race in 62, that kind of made me a little bit nervous, to be honest with you, about California Chrome. But we'll see what happens. Kentucky Derby, of course, will be around 6:24 this evening on NBC, the 140th annual running of the Roses. Be well over 100,000 people there. They do a tremendous job at fitting people in the how it's organized, getting one of great sporting events in this country. When we return, we'll get into some more NBA. First round, been a historic first round. We'll talk about that and much, much more in this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. We'll be right back. Welcome back to this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. A couple of NBA notes besides the playoffs and Donald Sterling. There was actually some other NBA news that transpired this week. Jack Ramsey passes away at the age of 89. Of course, he won a championship with that 76-77 Blazer team that, of course, came back down 2-0 and beat the 76ers. Julius Erving-led 76ers team back in the 77 finals, led by Bill Walton. Ramsey, of course, won a championship with them. He led St. Joe's to a Final Four. Just, you know, besides being a wonderful coach, just somebody who, when you listen to all the coaches around, to multiple coaches around him, the Huey Browns of the world, that this guy seemed to be just ahead of his time as far as fitness, as far as from X and O standpoint, really emphasized team play and was, besides being a Hall of Fame coach, was a Hall of Fame broadcaster. I mean, you ever heard Jack Ramsey on the air in terms of on the radio? Is, you know, he's just one of the best. And I don't listen to basketball on the radio. I think basketball is just not made, in my opinion, it's not made for radio. But he, you know, he was good enough to make to where you could listen to basketball on radio, on the NBA on radio. But it's unfortunate that you know, his passing is that the Donald Sterling situation kind of takes away from, you know, from the attention that he deserved as just being a Hall of Fame coach, a beloved NBA figure, iconic NBA figure. And I just wanted to kind of like talk about him because he was a guy who just, you know, was ahead of his time as far as when it came to the coaching, coaching. I mean, these guys taught clinics all over the world. He's been brought in as a consultant from, you know, on with the Olympics and with FIBA and different basketball venues from that standpoint. And, you know, he was a legendary NBA figure who passed away. He had been sick for a long time now, but passed away at the age of 89. Mike D'Antoni out as a Los Angeles Lakers head coach. When D'Antoni decided that he wanted his option picked up for the 2015-2016, that was going to be all she wrote. There was no way that the Lakers were going to pick up that option before the season started. Let's be honest, D'Antoni never should have been hired as a Laker head coach. You're never going to win a championship with Mike D'Antoni. And again, I'm not going to blame the season on Mike D'Antoni. That roster was dreadful. That was one of the worst rosters in the NBA. I don't care who coaches the Lakers this year. It wouldn't have mattered. They would not make the playoffs. No Kobe Bryant. Gasol is banged up. The thing that hurts D'Antoni is his lack of flexibility. Like D'Antoni, you know, you have Paul Gasol, who will be a Hall of Famer, in my opinion, and was one of the most skilled big men in the league, and still is. And you can't figure out a way to use him. I mean, you can't. I mean, he did the same thing with the Knicks. You know, he just can't. He's just not a flexible coach. He's not a guy. You know, he has his way of doing things, and that's it. And that has caught up to him in his last couple jobs. I mean, he's resigned from his last two jobs, from the Knicks and from the Lakers. Now, I'm not saying that these have been the greatest situations, but he's made bad situations even worse with his just, you know, lack of defense, because he doesn't preach any defense, and just a lack of flexibility offensively. Now, Don Nelson is a coach who is a Hall of Fame coach who's a great, great offensive coach who doesn't preach defense. But Don Nelson is extremely flexible offensively. I mean, the stretch four, things of that nature. Don Nelson is an offensive innovator. So that's what will get Don Nelson into the Hall of Fame versus Mike D'Antoni, who's not flexible at all. We are now joined by Robert Sapp, who's made a couple of appearances on this show, just to say the least. whether you're talking basketball, NFL, Breaking Bad, you know, we cover all the bases here. Mr. Sapp, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, doing well. Had to sleep in after watching that Blazers-Houston game last night.
Yeah, these games, I mean, all right, like the first round of playoffs has just ruined my sleeping life over the past couple of weeks because of how late these games are. And then, you know, you don't want to miss them, especially the West Coast games. You don't want to miss them. Because, you know, they're either going down to the last second or going to double overtime and what have you. You would agree that this has been the best first round that you've ever seen.
Oh, that was going to be my absolute first statement, that this is definitely the best first round I have ever seen.
In my lifetime,
I can't remember a playoff, first round, just everything. Just there's literally nothing. It was like the Damian Lillard shot last night was just like, oh, yep, okay, check that off. The greatest series, greatest first round ever. We need a walk-off, game-winning. Yep, got that one too. So it's just like almost everything you could check off in terms of like, you know, amazing basketball moments, you can check off that. As well as, you know, a historic banning of a owner for life. You know, just your average run-of-the-mill playoff.
yeah, it's been a wild week to say the least in the NBA. I mean, it really began this time last week. It really began with the whole Sterling stuff coming out this time last Saturday. We'll get to the Sterling stuff. I mean, certainly plenty of layers of that story, and certainly a new one last night with, you know, his mistress coming out of the woodwork, which is no surprise at all with Barbara Walters. And I was just waiting. I was surprised it took that long. But we'll get to that.
It was going to be either Barbara or Oprah.
I think Oprah's too. Oprah's worried about buying a Clipper, so that might help Barbara in the
Yeah.
So, how about, you know, you're going to have five game sevens, And I was thinking about this. Out of these five game sevens, what team to you has the most to lose? Out of the five,
yeah.
Look at out of five game sevens, which team?
Yeah. It's got to be the Thunder, right? It's got to be the Thunder. Like, even with San Antonio, because that'll be the other one. You like the number one. Oh, wait, hold on. Oops, I forgot about the other number. Okay, all right. Thunder, because my argument would be the Thunder because of they will start to get an inkling of the pressure that Miami faced. Because if that group cannot just get out of the first round, then that is going to be almost as devastating as probably what everybody else would go, the Pacers. Scott Brooks' job will be on the line going back to Oklahoma. You know, the Westbrook and Durant stuff will kick up to nuclear level. And the pressure will be on Durant in a way it hasn't been on him before, particularly, you know, the article, Mr. Unreliable, got a lot of play. He responded well. But if he doesn't have a standout game, then that will help to have those kinds of sentiments ring true. So I would argue the Thunder, but I can definitely see the argument of the Pacers.
Yeah, I think you can go either way with the Thunder or the Pacers. I would lean towards the Thunder because I think the Thunder, frankly, are a better team than the Pacers as far as just having those two guys. It's been a couple of years now. They've been together for a while now, and it's like, at what point, at what point can they break through and get back to the NBA Finals? And then plus, you can't lose a game at home to a team that is going to basically be down two starters. I mean, Zach Randolph, and I was going to continue, that was going to be my next point. Zach Randolph's suspension hampered Mike Conley, who said he would not be playing if it were the regular season with the hamstring. I would agree. I think the Thunder would be the bigger disappointment. That, I mean, people thought Thunder could win the championship, so you're going out in the first round, you know, championship to first round defeat would definitely be a devastating loss to them. How about the Zach Randolph suspension? All the talk about NBA suspensions were supposedly going to be on Paul George and whether or not he gets suspended. So it comes out.
Yeah.
I thought Paul George was going to be suspended because based on the history of that rule, you take one step or a couple steps off the bench in a fight or a melee of that magnitude, then that's automatic suspension. We saw it with the Knicks. We saw it with Phoenix. We've seen it a couple times. So I was happy with the NBA when they didn't suspend Paul George. I was like, okay, they're going to have their best player back. Okay, I'm fine. They finally used discretion. Then it comes out a couple hours later that Zach Randolph is suspended. And I saw the play live, and I didn't even think about there being a possibility of Zach Randolph being suspended. Do you think the NBA made the right call?
I have completely forgotten that had even happened. I watched that whole game wire to wire, and it just didn't even register with me. So, it's a tough pill to swallow if you're Memphis, but you can't throw a punch at another player. You know, it's just like, you would have liked to have seen him use discretion. It didn't register with me, but it's hard for me to sit here and be outraged by it because, you know, it's on tape. You got it on tape. He obviously throws the blow to Adams, whatever Adams did. We know he's an irritant, you know. You can't do that. If you're a veteran player, you're playing, you know, Jason, you can't let your emotions get out of check in order to do that. So do I think that it was suspension worthy. I mean, probably not. No, but you can't do it.
You can't do it, but I think the NBA had an opportunity to kind of take advantage of everything that was going on. You got down.
Yeah.
You got, you know, you have all these things that have happened. Had they not suspended him, nobody would have been crying had he not been suspended.
I don't think
Oklahoma City would have said anything. I don't think anybody would have said anything. Like you said, you were watching the game start to finish and didn't even think about it. Me neither.
Yeah.
So I think if you're the NBA, you have a game 7, you see Mike Conley's banged up, I think you got to use some some common sense. Be like, look, okay, we want to make this game as competitive as possible. We have a game 7. I don't think you suspend them. I think it's a judgmental call anyway. I think it's judgmental. I don't think it's automatic where we have to suspend them. So I think that's why the NBA kind of missed it.
You want to know what the next thought that came to my mind after it was like, ooh, wow, like, man, I didn't even remember that happening. He got suspended. The next thought that came to my mind was the NBA bailed the Thunder out. The immediate thought, this is just Robert sitting in watching the TV, no hearing things, just immediate thought was just like, I bet the NBA got, we needed something like that to happen so the Thunder wouldn't be bounced out of the first round. That was just kind of like my immediate reaction. The NBA definitely bailed the Thunder out on this one.
That's an old school NBA. We can't have the second location in the NBA Finals. Are you kidding me? Kobe and Shaq not the finals? You know, Joey Bob, get this right. Conspiracy theory moves to say
that. Come on. Think about it. Like, you can't, like, man, remember the year when Dirk won the MVP and got bounced out in that first round?
Yes, I do. He had Golden State. It's
a horrible look for your MVP to be bounced out in the first round. So that's kind of like why I say just like a sigh of relief. Do I think they did it on purpose? No. But I think seeing that punch, it was like, yep, let's suspend them. Boom, one game. Like, there wasn't going to be a shadow on top that was going to happen in their minds.
In NBA mind, like, listen, we're better off with Oklahoma City in the second round anyway. So let you know. If you guys can't win it now, then we did our job.
But as a basketball fan, it just sucks, you know, because there's literally no difference between. I mean, it's a perfect matchup for Memphis. And it's probably the worst matchup the Thunder are going to face. Just in terms of this counter of style. So it's just been a perfect matchup to watch in that sense. You know, one team each other trying to take away what they do best. And both of the kind of like the takeaways of the other team's strength. Memphis slow. We know the story. The script slow down, pound you inside. That's a Thunder weakness. Thunder love to run. You know, get the games into the high hundreds. You know, the lot of threes. The matchup between Tony Allen and Kevin Durant has been legendary. You know, just so you hate to see that this game 7 will be decided potentially by a suspension. That's not the way you wanted to see this epic series end.
No question about it. How about Golden State and the Clippers? Of course, they have a game 7 tonight, the last game 7 of the night. Now, I don't know if you heard the comments. Doc Rivers talking about the employees. Did you hear that comment? That little.
No, I didn't.
Okay, so Doc Rivers comes on yesterday, and he's like, you know, just to give you a sense of how my day started, I had to go down to the Clippers complex or whatever, the offices, and I had to look at all these employees, I guess salespeople, marketers, things of that nature, all these other NBA employees that worked for Donald Sterling, and it was hurtful because, you know, they had tears in their eyes, and they really haven't had a voice. And he goes on this whole five-minute spiel. And the reason why I mention it is, we know what transpired in last week. We know the Clippers have been bombarded, you know, with this, dealing with this. I wonder, was it a smart move for Doc to kind of rehash it a day before your team has to play a game seven in a public, in a public sense, in front of the public, in the media? I just wonder about that. Like, you know, you. I get Doc, you know, see, Doc, here's what Doc is too good at times. Doc is great handling these situations. He's going to say the right things. But I wonder if he was too good in terms of feeling like he had to be the voice of these people that we'll probably never meet or we'll never see in terms of, you know, the secretaries, the janitors, the things that these people that have been just brutalized by Donald Sterling. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think it's two different things. I think one is and I thought about this a lot. You know, like, there is a very clear kind of story that we like to build out of, like, unfortunate situations, right? Like, you know, the team, we are one, we are collective, you know, we use this as motivation to, you know, propel us forward on a hopeful championship run. That's the feel-good story. That's the way in which we like to break down unfortunate situations. The problem with racism, and the problem with particularly with an institutionalized racism, because he was the Clippers institution by being an owner, of course, is that it leaves so many more lasting marks than, you know, a death of a family member, you know, who Brett Favre's father passing, you know, like, you know, something to rally around. This racism is so ugly, and it leaves such impacts on such a wide variety of people, and particularly, you know, me and you could speak to this, and being a black man, it sticks with you. So, as in other cases, you would be able to say, yeah, Doc Rivers will push this to aside, get his team focused, and like da-da-da-da-da. But on an emotional level, on like a deep down to your core emotional level, it's got to be hard to look everybody in the eye on a day-to-day, on a day-to-day basis, particularly when it's not like they could just focus on playing. Like, the players can just focus on playing. The other people within the organization, in a very real way, their jobs are on the line. Everybody say, ooh, new owner, new owner, new owner. Okay, new owner comes in, they're going to bring in their own people. And so there's a lot of impact, and Doc has to be carrying, you know, We say Doc's great at handling these things. There's never been anything like this before.
No.
There's never been anything like this. And so, like, I think this is weighing heavy on the Doc because he's become the de facto face of the Clippers franchise, you know, which is heavy and hard when all of the conversation around them has actually nothing to do with basketball and has a large part to do with you know, what this country's been built off of ever since it's been inception. So it's got to be hard. That's my thing. And I think it would be easy for us to say, no, you know, focus on basketball and everything like that and da-da-da. Because of this situation, because of his owner being banned, which is insane just to say, you know, your owner has been banned. He now has to carry the load for the entire organization.
Are you satisfied with I shouldn't phrase it that way. Do you think I really want to hear from David Stern. We haven't heard from Stern, and I really want to hear. I badly want to hear from David Stern.
You're not going to hear from David Stern. No, of course not.
David is like, you know, he's not enjoying this, but he's going to stay as far as from this way from this as possible. So, and I don't blame him. But the reason why I would love to hear from David Stern is I'm not going to say, you know what, David Stern, you should have banned Sterling during your time. I'm not even going to go that far because I don't think they would have been able to ban Sterling based on some of the things that transpired off that were non-basketball related. And we're talking about the housing discrimination lawsuits. But, you know, I think that there could have been more that could have been done to pressure Sterling to maybe, you know, to get the other owners in the corner to where, like, listen, you can't keep doing this stuff. I think more could have been done, and it's unfortunate that it took this situation like this to where now a franchise is basically going to go. Listen, the Clippers could become the Clippers again easily. Easily. I mean, this thing goes into the courtroom. If he's still the owner come training camp or even in July, you know, those players are going to demand. I can't see those players not demanding free agency, some more legal things of that nature. I can't see Doc being the coach there or general manager there. This thing is far from over. You know, Adam Silver did what he had to do to kind of salvage these playoffs with this. And I think part of that was the move to salvage the playoffs by making this move and satisfying some people. But this thing, you know, Sterling, we know, is an ex-lawyer. He understands. He lives in courtrooms. So this thing is far from over. And, I just think that, you know, David Stern left Adam Silver with a pile of you know what, basically, with not dealing with this situation and kind of putting it aside. It's almost like he thought that Stern, you know, he'll either die or they'll just stink. So I think Stern really did the NBA and Adam Silver in particular a disservice by not handling this situation or not taking measures to handle this situation, not even trying to deal with this situation, because it seemed like the only thing that Stern did to Donald Sterling was fine him for moving the team from San Diego to L.A. It's the only thing he ever did in terms of Donald Sterling, which had nothing to do with racism. He just moved the team illegally to Los Angeles. So it'd be very interesting to see how this thing plays out come the off season. As far as the game goes, normally I wouldn't, you know, I mean, I would favor the Clippers because them being at home. I think this has been somewhat of a home court series, especially in the last two to three games. But again, Chris Paul banged up. Golden State you wonder if Golden State will be playing for Mark Jackson, considering that his job could be on the line. I give Golden State a pretty good chance in this game. What are your thoughts on the game?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I think that this has also been, you know, for probably different reasons than Memphis, Oklahoma City. This has also been a very close series, razor thin series, and I think it boils down to two players. It boils down to Steph Curry. And it boils down to Blake Griffin. And I think it'll be those two players that either, like, that decide, like, the fortunes of the franchise. If Curry can get off early and often, then that whenever Curry is explosive in his points, that just kind of, like, elevates the team. In a way that even when he's, like, getting double-digit assists, it doesn't do. And so that will be on the Golden State factor. On the Clippers side, I've been watching Chris Paul a lot. I've been watching him a lot in this series. And I think I've come to the conclusion, unless 100% healthy, and when has Chris Paul ever been 100% healthy?
Never. In the playoffs.
So outside – outside of that unlikely event happening, he's not a person that can dominate the game. He is just a facilitator. And so it then falls on Blake Griffin to be the one who can elevate his team to another level. And so it ends up being, can Blake Griffin be more unstoppable than Steph Curry? That's how I break down the fortunes of these two teams. But you give the Clippers the edge. You do give the Clippers the edge because they're at home.
Yes, yeah. I mean, you have to. I mean, 83% of these teams have won. 83% of home teams have won Game Sevens. So without question, Clippers are the better team from a talent standpoint. But again, with so many dynamics that are going into it, I give Golden State a better chance normally now than I normally would. I would say that coming into this game. I think the Clippers will win this game. I think the Clippers will win the game. I think it'll be a close game, but I wouldn't be shocked if Golden State won this game. Put it that way, would not at least be shocked if Golden State won this game. San Antonio Dallas, which has been just a classic series from start to finish. Had one bad game where San Antonio Dallas blew them out in game two. It seems like gets a sense of Dallas that, like, they're better than San Antonio. Like they play like they're better than San Antonio. I don't think they are from a talent standpoint, but they have this confidence against San Antonio that, you know, you don't see teams have playing the Spurs. And, you know, I wonder, you know, again, I think San Antonio wins game seven at home, but this Dallas team has a lot of confidence. Talk about Dallas and, you know, their chances going into this game seven.
Yeah, it's the old grizzled veteran. You know, you look at Dallas's team, and that's what they are. They are a bunch of veterans with experience and with just like no fear, and particularly Dirk Nowitzki. Now, he hasn't had a, you know, monster series. I don't even know if he's capable of having a monster series anymore. But he's been consistent enough, and I think they've taken cues from him in terms of, like, not being afraid of San Antonio, like not being in awe. Half of San Antonio's battles are won even before they step on the court. Yeah, everybody's just like, you know, I remember early in the season when San Antonio came and faced the Wizards. And basically after the game, all the comments were just like, man, they're amazing. They pass the ball. They move so fluidly. And that's the way basketball should be played. It's a clinic. It's like, man, you guys were defeated even before you stepped on the court. You were just all in awe of San Antonio. And so I say that to say that's not Dallas's mentality at all. There's zero being in awe. There's respect, particularly amongst Tim Duncan and Dirk Nowitzki, but there's definitely not a sense of being in awe. I think what San Antonio, what Dallas has been able to do is that it's been able to exploit the mental fragility, if that's the word, of some of the San Antonio role players. Like Kawhi Leonard hasn't been able to get off, you know, haven't heard of any Danny Green's, Mills hasn't been able to really get off. Like, they've really condensed the game into being a Tim Duncan, Tony Parker kind of Ginobili kind of take over, like just them, and kind of shut everybody out. And I think once you get down to that big three is super old, and sometimes they can do it, and then sometimes they can't physically and just getting up. And that's how you can slow down the series and break the the fantastic rhythm of when San Antonio is flowing, and that's when you can come out with an uneven plan. I mean, like, it's a shame. We talk about coaches. It's a shame that we probably have two of the best coaches in the league in game, and particularly in making in-game and series adjustments facing each other in the first round. But it's led to a fantastic first round matchup. Because you put any other coach in the league and give them Dallas's roster versus San Antonio.
I'm not sure they would be a playoff team. I mean, that's how good a job Carlisle has been done this year. I'm not sure just about any other coach that's especially in the Western Conference, that's even a playoff team. I mean, he has done wonders with that job. Just getting, Monte Ellis was one of the most hated players in the league. I mean,
mm-hmm.
in terms of like
mm-hmm.
the sabermetrics people, he's just a volume shooter. He's selfish. He's coming down.
Yep.
He's coming down. He's looking like an all star. So he's the,
yep.
I mean, you know, Vince Carter should be retired. His career is done. You know,
yep.
Sean Marion, he's still playing. I mean, just the amount, you know, even guys like Samuel Dalembert, he's still playing. Samuel Dalembert's still in the league. So he's getting more out of these guys that, you know, Brendan Wright, this roster is not a good roster. I'm looking at
nope.
the roster. You have a bunch of old veterans, wily old veterans, who are going toe-to-toe with a team who may have thought could went in as one of the favorites to win the NBA championship. So it was just a remarkable
mm-hmm.
job that he's done with his team. Amazing. I just can't overstate Carlisle and the job that he has done with this particular team. You know, I was thinking about this. You know, let's assume Oklahoma City wins tonight. What if you have a scenario where you have, all right, Kevin McHale has already lost with Houston. They were not expected to lose to Portland. He's out. You can have a situation, Vogel could be out, and Vogel, McHale, and Mark Jackson. Which one of those three guys loses their jobs if they're done at the first round?
It sounds like Mark Jackson, which I don't get it. I mean, but Vogel, it's Vogel if he loses this series. Like, he has to know that he is, right, Vogel's one of the choices, right? Or maybe
right.
I just made him
no,
the choice in
no,
my
Vogel,
head.
No,
Vogel's
no,
one of the choices.
Yeah, Vogel,
yeah.
Kevin McHale, and Mark Jackson.
Yeah, Vogel in a very real way, not in a very real way, in the realest way possible, is coaching for his job.
Yes.
Like that, there's no coming back from this loss, unless there's some piece of information that's forthcoming that we just don't know yet. Otherwise, in a very real way, he's coaching for his job. I think the X factor one I probably focus on a little bit more than that, is just Mark Jackson. And I'm fairly confused as to why he would be on the hot seat. But it looks like that if they were to lose this series, that Mark Jackson will also lose his job. And so in a very sneaky way, I think the person who probably has the hottest seat might be Mark Jackson.
Yeah, I think him and Vogel are probably close to being neck and neck. To give you background on Mark Jackson, he had a number of issues with his assistant coaches. He demoted Brian Scalabrine, who was one of his top
yeah.
assistants early, to the D-League. Now, he wanted to fire Mike Scott. He wanted to fire him, but the upper management wouldn't allow him to do that because they liked Scalabrine. Okay, so he had a situation with that. Recently, he got rid of one of his ex-coaches who he claimed was allegedly taping conversations that coaches,
yeah.
that the coaches were having amongst each other. And the reason why the guy said he was taping them, because there was talk that that Mark Jackson was talking to him behind his back to
uh-huh.
other players. So he's had a ton of issues with his assistant coaches. I think upper management is not happy in terms of they think the team is underachieved, which I don't agree with. And
right, I don't get that at all.
And they think that they think that he just, they like, the assistants that he had trouble with, they apparently like. I think that it's more about, I think it's more about, less about on the court performance.
It's organizational politics.
Organizational,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, kind of
know.
Stuff that did Lionel Hollins in. Even
right,
though his team
right,
was performing,
exactly.
It was the politics of the organization and how he interacted with that group as being the key. And I hear that, and I hear all that. And it's just, but it's such a short-sighted view, you know. It's such a short-sighted view. I guess I'm still more annoyed by the Lionel Hollins thing, because I think the Grizzlies were taking the necessary steps,
right,
in terms of basketball moves and the way that the team was being coached. And I think that, you know, it's hard when you are a franchise that has been desolate for such a long time to suddenly get the hubris of, oh, well, we're here now. We should, you know, a coach should want to be, You should be happy that you're in the playoffs for a little bit
right.
of time,
right.
and
right.
then let
exactly.
it, then build the infrastructure around a coach that is maximized like what this franchise has been able to do, so that he can do bigger and better things. And that's the piece that annoys me more so than not with these kind of what I would define as really rash, short-sighted ways of viewing their head coaches.
No question about it. One of the problems in it is one of the biggest problems in the NBA. You got organizations that don't have a clue what they're doing, and I'm a fan of one of them. We don't have a coach anymore. So the Lakers, D'Antoni being out, and just to no surprise, because he wanted his option picked up of 2015-2016. So you're gonna have a couple of jobs. Jobs open. Are you fearful that this first round has been so good that everything else is just going to be a complete letdown for the rest of the playoffs? Are you fearful about that up until the finals? And you think you're going to get back to the finals?
Yeah, I mean, no, I'm not fearful of that. And I think the reason why these have been, the first round games have been so good is in a very real way, there's a bit of a shift that's going on in the NBA. I think you have a plethora of talented teams, and you have a lack of fantastic coaching. And so a lot of these games are going to be close because the talent level on the floor is close enough, and there won't be the rapid adjustments that are being made by the great ones. Like we see in the Golden State, you know, it takes them two or three games to make a shift. It takes a while for teams to make shifts because the coaches aren't as quick on the uptake as the better coaches in the league. I think I like the matchup a lot in the second round. I like the matchup a lot.
So potentially you'll have
a potential matchup.
Yes, you have Clippers. Let's assume that let's play the chalk game for a second.
Yeah.
Clippers, OKC.
Tremendous matchup.
Yes.
Just tremendous.
San Antonio, Portland. Portland is a wild
Portland.
Card. Portland's
coming, boy. Portland's coming. That team.
They
have been the most impressive team of the first round, I would say.
I would agree with that. I think they've been, they just play so well. They play. The thing that jumps out about y'all, Portland, is how well they play together. And that series, now that was a great series in itself. Man. I mean, mm-hmm. those games were closely contested, overtime games. Yep. You know, Houston easily could have won 4-2, but Portland not having, you know, Aldridge was tremendous throughout the series, but even the games where they slowed him down, you saw Lillard, you saw Batum.
Lillard. Mm-hmm.
How about Wesley Matthews? The defense on Harden, and then having games where he had like 25 or 26 points.
Yeah.
So they play together as well as almost any team in the league. It seems like they are just an offensive juggernaut. I would keep my eyes on Portland, and I did not like them going to the playoffs because I just didn't think defensively experienced. They haven't advanced past the first round since 2000. That was, of course, when they lost to the Lakers in the Western Conference Finals. So, it had been that long. Amazingly, it had been that long since they gotten won a playoff series. But that, I mean, Lillard is just – that guy just has no conscience. I mean, that shot off the dribble, 0.9 seconds left, is just, you know, you almost knew it was going in. I mean, it looked good from the time it left his hand. They're a team to watch because I think they can give San Antonio some problems, just how they play. I mean, now San Antonio might win that series on experience, but that would be some of a great series.
Yeah. Yeah. So the West, I literally don't even have, like, the only the only matchup that might be on the letdown is potentially – we're looking too far ahead. But if Oklahoma City and San Antonio faced in the championship round, I don't necessarily like that matchup for San Antonio. That should be. So the West, you're just not even concerned about it. At least I'm not. I think pretty much every matchup aligns fantastically. On the Eastern side, you need the Brooklyn Nets to come through.
You need them
to come through because you need that Miami Nets series. You just need that. You need that just to put in a little bit of oomph. Because while whoever the winner out of the Pacers Hawks going to go up against the Wizard, that is still not going to have sizzle to it. It's still going to be more about, like, if the Pacers are come through, it's going to be more about the Pacers, you know, and their just dysfunction. Like, they're just dysfunctional. And so, like, that brings its own kind of the reason why the games would be close and, like, stuff like that would probably not be about the great basketball that's being played, but it would be about, you know, why is Hibbert doing what he's doing and, you know, what is going on in Frank Vogel's head and why did he – it will be like all – I'm not expecting a uplift of quality of basketball coming from the Pacers. And then the Hawks, you know, They're the Hawks. It just pretty much says it all. I mean, they have some talent, but they're extremely helter-skelter in their play. And you could probably say the same thing about the Wizards. And so I'm just like that. My main point is just that series, however it shakes out, I'm not as excited about the quality of basketball that I would be with, of course, the Western Conference matchup and even a Heat Nets matchup. I think that would be a quality series, even though the Heat are obviously the favorites and the better case.
Here's what you need to happen. The West, the matchups are fine. It doesn't matter which matchups you get. I think they're going to be great matchups, I feel. The East, you need two series to happen before the finals. You need Heat, Brooklyn, and you need the Heat and the Wizards.
Pacers.
I think that those.
Oh, Heat, Wizards,
no,
yeah.
No, Wizards. Not the Pacers. I didn't know.
Yeah, okay, not good. I was like,
Because the Wizards are a team that fun to watch, young stars on the upswing. You know, they could be that young team of the future. They could play that team of the future type. In that team of future type role, you know, great for the city of D.C., you know what I mean, from that standpoint. So putting D.C. back on the map. So they have, you know, they have, you know, like I said, they have guys who have potential or potential stars with Wall and Beal. They have good players. You know, they wouldn't beat the Heat, but they could give the Heat some problems in terms of the matchups. So you would like to see that. You would love to see that series. And, of course, Brooklyn, how much, you know, they hate the Heat, beat the Heat four times. You can't have the Hawks in the second round of playoffs. You can't. That would just destroy
it. So true.
The fact that the Hawks – I mean,
so
you look
true.
At some of the names.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen a roster this bad? I mean, the fact that I did that Indiana's in a Game 7 with a roster with Mike Scott on it. Mike Scott, you know, forget about Teague, forget about Millsap. You have Mike Scott, you have Goran Ancic, and you have these guys that we have never heard of.
Yep.
You have to have to play fantasy basketball to know who these guys are.
It's true.
And that's
it's
it. If you have the Hawks, a team that won 37 games in the second round of playoffs, it'd just be bad. It'd be bad for the league.
Yeah.
It'd be bad for the league. So from that standpoint, the NBA needs the Pacers to win badly. You need the NBA Pacers to win. You have, a Pacers Wizards series. That'd be a nice series. You have a good defensive team versus a great offensive team. That'd be a nice matchup. I think the Eastern Conference can live. You can live with the Eastern Conference: Brooklyn, Miami, Pacers, Wizards. I think those would be two pretty good matchups.
Yeah.
But if the Hawks find their way, put it this way, if you have the Hawks and the Raptors in the second round, oh my goodness, I don't even want to pretend like that'd be NBA TV.
That's NBA TV land.
Yes. Oh my goodness, jeez. I mean, listen. The Raptors are a much better team than the Hawks. I mean, they're much more. They have more. DeRozan is talented. Hopefully Kyle Lowry can get healthy. We know how talented he is. But just a matchup standpoint, you can't have those two teams going up against the Heat and the Wizards. You can't have it.
Yeah.
You can't have it.
Yeah.
But then I have a possibility that you can have the Hawks or the Raptors in the Eastern Conference Finals. I think the Wizards will beat either. I think that's the scary part. I think the Wizards will definitely beat the Hawks, without question. I just don't want to see there be a possibility that the Raptors or the Hawks get to the Eastern Conference Finals. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't want – no, because you had a Raptors – let's say the Raptors – we know the Heat, the healthy Heat, will beat the Raptors. But let's say LeBron pulls a hamstring. You had the possibility to have the Raptors in the Eastern Conference Finals.
Yeah. That's a terrifying thought.
That's terrifying. You know, like these playoffs are one injury away. Even Dwayne Wade, one injury away from a team with no business being in the Eastern Conference Finals, being in the Eastern Conference Finals. I mean, I guess you can live with Indiana being in the Eastern Conference Finals. You can live with it. You wouldn't go crazy.
Yeah.
You wouldn't expect them to do it, but you can live with it. You cannot live with the Hawks or the Raptors being in the Eastern Conference Finals. You can't. It can't happen. It cannot happen.
Yep.
So I think if you are a fan, you're rooting hard for the Pacers. You're rooting hard for Brooklyn to advance. So if those two teams advance, then I think you will have a great set of second round games. I mean, listen, what we just saw in the first round, we may not ever see again. It's been that good. But at least in the second round, you'll have compelling. We know what the West is going to bring. You're going to have some compelling matchups. But at least the East will be watchable with Brooklyn and Indiana. But, you cannot have the Atlanta. Again, just cannot have the Atlanta Hawks, just nowhere near the second round of playoffs, not even just close. And, again, I'm a little nervous about that game, man. Indiana's been so helter-skelter. I'm not assuming by any measures that
– No, you can't.
You can't with Indiana.
Yeah.
You can't. I just don't know with them. You don't know what they're going to show. You don't know the mindset. You don't know if they're going to get comfortable. You don't. I mean, I think the game would be better off being played in Atlanta for Indiana's sake. I think it's home court disadvantage for the way the Pacers have played at home. I mean, you think about it, Atlanta has beaten them soundly. Three of the last four times they played in Indiana, they've beaten them soundly. Not just beaten them, just destroyed them.
Yeah,
so again,
no,
Jeff,
you can't depend on the Pacers right now.
No. With that being said, as of right now, you still think that the Heat are favorites for a three-peat?
On the three-peat. I mean, they're favorites to get to the finals by far. I mean, like that. You can't even imagine them losing that. It will depend on the matchup. You know, it honestly will depend on the matchup for the Heat. The potential four that are coming out of the West are a strong four. They're a strong four, particularly with the ascension of Blake Griffin and Aldridge on the other two teams.
Right.
I would want to see the matchup. I would want to see it. I want to look at it and analyze it, which would be fun to do because you slightly favor the Heat, but not by it will be a close one, as last year was close. It'll be in that area.
So
clear
you think
cut
that,
to win a third championship, I don't think it's clear cut.
Okay. So you think they would have problems with? You look at the potential four. They would have major problems with either with San Antonio, the Clippers, or even the Blazers.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they're probably the best matchup is
OKC.
So that's probably their best matchup. But even that matchup is going to give them a lot of problems. So I mean, there's not an easy matchup in that. Whoever comes out of the West will be by far the strongest competitor.
Yes. I mean, I wonder, I just thought about this. I wonder if it's a possibility. Remember with the football, you had Seattle, you know, going through the minefields they had to go through to get to the Super Bowl, facing a Denver team that was, you know, the favorites and, you know, had Peyton Manning, what have you, different dynamic. But you wonder, whoever comes out the West, are they going to be just so battle-tested that it will be just their year? You wonder about that.
The quality of play, and I said this to our mutual friend Chad, the quality of play in the West is at such a high level
that
it's just a different style of defense that's being – no, uh-uh. The quality of play in the East is
much higher.
It's just
bad.
It's not.
No.
There's no better defense that's being played. It's just bad. It's sloppy. No. It's bad. It's ugly over there. And so the quality of play that the West is going to bring to the East finals is going to be at such a level that. You know, it's not that – I mean, the Heat are two-time champions, so they'll be able to rise to it. It's just like that team would have been used to playing at that high level for such a long time that it might take the Heat a couple of games to get back into it. If that happens, it's anything goes. It's anything goes.
Yeah, you do get a sense with these playoffs, and I've gotten, you know, it's funny with these, you know, from the start of these playoffs, you do get a sense that the title is more up for grabs this year than it has been in about a decade, you know, in a long time, for that matter. Because, I mean, we've had repeat teams, we've had dominant teams, we've had teams where you just said, hey, this is the team to beat, that's the team to beat. You do get a sense that this title is kind of up for grabs.
And I think that's been the high level. That's been the reason for the high level of play and the even matchups. Everybody looks around, you know, for the first time in a while. I think teams are looking, like, at the beginning of the playoffs, looked around and said, why not us? Like, for real, why not us? Why can't we do this? You know, and that's why you've literally seen, like, no, like, the only, probably the only matchup that was just, you know, not even a contest with the Bulls versus the Bobcats. You know, just like, there's no chance. Get out of here. Everybody else, and particularly the West, is just like, no, let's, everybody's bringing their big guns, and then we're just going at it. Because we believe, as you believe, that you have a championship, that we have a championship roster, which is made for, of course, like an amazing playoff series.
No, without question. I wonder, what are you thinking right now if you're Kevin Durant? And let's say they're going to get through this series, but let's say you finish it. Let's say you don't win a championship this year. If you're Kevin Durant, do you think to yourself, like, man, will I ever win a championship playing with Russell Westbrook? Does those thoughts creep into your mind?
Here's the thing. As Kevin Durant, you have to ask yourself, have you been the leader that you need to be, right? Like, if Kevin Durant has gone to Westbrook and said, this is my team, you know, had that current, however they had it, this is my team, this is the things that we need to do, and Westbrook has willfully done the opposite through that conversation, then, or after those conversations, those talks, then, yeah, I think you can legitimately be like, you know, this is not, you can start thinking, is this ever going to work? I've talked to him over and over. He sat there, he's giving me the yes, and that he understands that we're going to break this down, like, da-da-da, and he goes out and does something else. The thing I think you got to check for with Durant, and what Durant needs to check for himself, is that, yeah, that quiet leadership, you know, set the example, always say the right thing.
It doesn't work.
It works to a certain point, and it works to a certain point with certain types of players. Westbrook is the player that you need to go yoke him up and say, stop doing this. We need to do it like that. And if he hasn't done that, then I don't think it will be fair for him to be like, oh, you know, this will never work. If you haven't taken and tried to assume that leadership, if you've let this thing be a 1A, 1B type of deal, then really, we know Westbrook. Westbrook's a scorer. That's what he wants to do. You know, that is in his DNA. And so if that conversation, if that hasn't been pushed on Kevin Durant's part, I think Kevin Durant needs to look in the mirror a little bit.
See, I think that they, you know, I think Westbrook is, obviously, you're absolutely right. He is a natural scorer. He's in a point guard's body. I just think that this complete lack of leadership hurts that team. Like, I'm thinking about the Westbrook thing, and I'm just thinking Kobe and Shaq, and I'm thinking all this talent the Lakers had in the early years with those two, and a Dale Harris, a Kurt Rambis, those guys just couldn't. Couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And
you
need that alpha dog coach, Phil Jackson, Doc Rivers. There's not that many of them. Greg Popovich, we all know. It's not. They're few and far between. Rick Carlisle now.
Mm-hmm.
You need that kind of coach. Even Larry Brown, that kind of coach to, I think, direct those two and say, look, I got a ring. I know what it takes to win a ring. I just don't think this, you know, Scott Brooks, I think I put Scott Brooks in that category, very good coach, but I'm not sure Scott Brooks is a championship coach. I'm looking at adjustments not being made. I'm looking at, you know, I'm just looking at just not being, not
lack
not
of
being,
offensive sets coming out of timeouts.
Drives me crazy. I'm looking at the, like you said, continuity. Why is Durant having trouble getting the ball? It's beyond just Russell Westbrook taking too many shots. That's the easy excuse to say that's a problem.
Yeah, I agree.
That's an easy cop-out. I've said that time and time again, especially in this postseason. It's lack of offense and just structure. What is their offense? What is their what is their philosophy to their offense? Do they have an identity offensively? To me, it's just like give Westbrook and Durant the ball, and you just do what you do. That's what I see.
Right.
And they're so talented that more times than not, you can get away with that. In the regular season, you can get away with that. But you get in the playoffs against quality coaching, against good defenses, that's going to get exploited. So I just think that, you know, I don't know if Scott Brooks has received enough attention, negative attention, as far as just what he's doing or what he's trying to do. I just don't see it with Scott Brooks. And I think that, you know, I don't know how many coaches are out there. There are not a lot of quality coaches, but I think that in order for this thing to work with those two being on the same team, that they need that kind of alpha dog, alpha male, alpha dog coach to direct them. They need a dictator.
Yeah. I don't disagree with any of that. I'm looking squarely at Scott Brooks, squarely at him.
We've seen this year after year. This is nothing new. His lack of adjustments, his lack of things like, what are you doing? Like, why, you know, him, you know, not realizing that Kendrick Perkins couldn't play against the Miami Heat because of the small lineup. Like, why couldn't you figure, the fans could figure it out. Everybody watching could figure it out, but you could not figure this out. Like, how long it takes you to make adjustments, you know, and it's just, I think, you reach a certain level. Certain coaches have a certain, like, just like players. Certain players have a certain ceiling on their talent and ability. I see that with coaches.
Yeah.
Certain coaches have a ceiling on how good they are and how good they're going to be. And I definitely think that with I think we're starting to see that with Scott Brooks. I mean, because this team, again, I think they. You look at that roster. That's a championship roster, as far as I'm concerned. I'm like, under the current collective bargaining agreement, maybe they can get another shooter, possibly. But I think all the pieces are there for them to win an NBA championship. When you have two of the top 10 players in the league, you should be able to win an NBA championship.
That is a championship roster. As a matter of fact, I was so disgusted with the TBS team or whatever. That when they were talking about, you know, the TNT team, when they were talking about, oh, Kevin Durant, he doesn't have a lot of help, and I almost wanted to throw something through my screen. I was like, because they were trying to compare it to, like, LeBron and Cleveland. Don't do that.
No,
that is not even. You can't. Yeah. Don't do that. Don't even remotely try to put that in a package. It's not even true. He doesn't have enough help. The Thunder are absolutely a championship contender at the very least. You know, it's not a championship team. You know, at the very most. You're absolutely right. The difference that it looks like, and this is the key piece, the difference it looks like is that connection between Riley Spoelstra, right? You can't split those two up. Maybe Spoelstra is now more coming into his own and stuff like that, but particularly early on, those two were linked at the hip, which allowed for the kind of the hardened edge that you needed to have to get through a championship, because a championship run is more of a mental grind than anything else.
Right.
Because like we said, and for a while, the talent out there is fairly equivalent, you know, not since probably the Lakers, that three-peat run, you know. Has there been a team that just kind of overwhelmed you with talent? I think maybe that the year after the championship run with the Heat, they had that year run where everything was kind of like clicking, and they were obviously just you know, better than most teams. But right now the championship landscape, the talent is dispersed and even enough, as we said, that a lot of teams feel like they can win it. It's that mental grind that's going to be what separates the contender from the champion. And part of that mental grind is that your coach has the mental toughness / pedigree to push his team past. And I think having O'Reilly to prop up Eric Spoelstra push that team past that pedigree. As great of a GM as Scott Presti is, you know, and there's still no championship pedigree to prop up a Scott Brooks to push this team through the ups and downs. And so what is happening is they are relying purely and solely on talent, and that will only get you so far.
Question about it. We've seen a lot. Listen, we saw it with the Sacramento Kings. I mean, you know, so, you know, you can't, talent will only get you so far if you don't have that mental toughness. We've seen it with Indiana. We've seen it with a couple teams over the years, I mean, where it's just that sheer talent is not enough in the NBA, especially now, like you said, with the talent, level of talent being basically close to being not always even, but pretty much where it's not a big, you're seeing the Western Conference, like the difference between a 2, a 7, a 1, an 8, a 3, and a 6 is not that gap is not that big. But that's going to wrap it up for this particular, That's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. Hopefully the second round will be as exciting as the first round. We'll get the right matchups, no Atlanta Hawks, no Toronto Raptors, especially no Atlanta Hawks in the second round. And we'll talk to you soon, Mr. Sapp. Thanks for coming on.
Val, it's been a pleasure.
All right.
Come.
So that was Robert Sapp joining us. So going to wrap it up for this edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. I will see you next time. Have a great weekend. So long.